This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
I'm Jordan Robinson, host of the new podcast, The Women's Hoop Show. Each episode, I'll be joined by a rotating group of women's basketball experts to talk WNBA, college hoops, the new unrivaled league, and the shifting landscape of the sport. The game is growing, and so are we. Listen to and follow The Women's Hoop Show and Odyssey Podcast, available now for free on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. Sorry, Seth and I are talking about higher education off the
air. Sean and I are workshopping my next YouTube channel. Yes. I'm basically going to do a star test prep in an entertaining way.
With humor.
For social,
yeah.
I'll do a social studies star test. So kids can study for the star, but also get, you know, hooked on Seth Payne.
Payne and hooked on history or whatever topic it may be.
Yeah, that's good too and all, but mostly
hooked,
you know,
on you.
A conduit into sports radio.
Well, I mean, it's not, channel's not going to stick around unless they get hooked on you. Yes, and if you can somehow take that and bridge it into our show, selfishly, I would really approve of that.
I do enjoy people that do like little nice little synopsises of historical things.
Yeah, man.
With good storytelling.
Yeah, yeah, and you and I
would be like drunk history, but with stone cold sober.
Right.
History.
Drunk history with you would be really fun too. Just you,
drunk,
not the students.
Drunk history for middle schoolers.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. That'll. Hey kids.
Whatever truth.
Well, what your teachers are telling you, but here's the real story.
Here's the real
about the
skinny
way the world works.
That's right. All right. So the topic we teased into this segment was how do the Texans become a top five defense? Which I honestly think, like, based on the moves they've made this offseason and based on what the eye test looked like with that team last year, if you can, you know, some people will divorce themselves of all the big plays the Texans gave up on defense. I bet there's a lot of people like, wait a second, they weren't a top five defense already? Like, they sure do have a lot of really good guys on this team.
No, and in terms of what did we say last year, it would always feel like, man, 95% of the time the Texans are awesome.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden, they let up a huge chunk play.
Mm-hmm.
This is how impressive they were in terms of making plays. Second most interceptions, fourth most sacks, third most pass breakups. They were second in tackles for a loss, and they had the lowest completion percentage allowed by quarterbacks.
You would think, like, if you were just blindly saying, a defense that has those stats, where do you think they rank in scoring defense? I would be like, yeah, top five for sure.
14th.
Yeah, 14th.
In points allowed.
Right.
Right. And whenever I bring this up, immediately where I get pushback is people say, well, it's because the offense put them in bad positions.
That's the first text we got
after
I teased this topic. How do they get to be a top five defense? Have a better offense so they don't
right.
Not out on the field for three-fourths of the game.
That is true. That's partly true. But part of it, though, too, is that there were things last year where they had too many mistakes in coverage. They had too many errors at times, whether they be technique or mental errors, where they were just flat out, like, there was a good pass rush up front, but the safety got sucked upfield and split the corner in the safety, and he's off to the races. In terms of big plays, they allowed 10 touchdown passes, touchdowns on passes of 20 or more yards. That was third most in the NFL.
Wow.
They got targeted deep at the second highest rate in the league. So a lot of it is, you know, Kalen Bullock was a young safety. Jimmy Ward at times just got caught looking old at times. And then there were a lot of other times when there was a rotating cast of safeties working in, whether it's MJ Stewart or anybody else from at any given time.
Well, and this
or
is
Eric Murray.
Yeah, when this is only one play, but think of the play against the Cowboys only touchdown in that game. Jeff Okuda gets matched up in the slot on Kevontae Turpin.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah. And,
off to the races.
Okuda gave up his inside leverage, but at the same time, even though it wasn't Kalen Bullock's mistake on paper, a veteran safety and maybe a second-year Kalen Bullock kind of has an eye on that stuff and catches it, and it doesn't end up being a touchdown at least. So Kalen Bullock's a huge X factor in this. that he needs to continue working on what he did last year, which is he got smarter. He was in position more as the season went along. And sometimes it's as simple as just the angles that he's taking. So that's a, you know, your job as a deep safety is to make plays above and beyond what your actual responsibilities are. And he did make a lot of progress on that as the season went along.
They gave up a lot of chunk plays on the ground too.
Yeah, it was it wasn't just most runs of 20 plus yards.
Yeah, so it wasn't like it's. I mean, the big long pass plays are the ones that sizzle, and I think some of that too is the fact that in the very first game of the year they gave up four of those types of plays to Anthony Richardson. It's almost like first impressions are such a big deal, and the only thing that kept the Colts in the game in week one was Anthony Richardson just chunking the ball as far as he could throw it down the field, and it working a few times.
Yeah, and the you know the interesting thing is that the runs, I think they did some things defensively against the run that paid off, and we saw the Jaguars game was a big one where the defensive tackles tightened their alignment down on that QB sneak on the goal line, and that ended up being the turning point in that game. That was the clutch moment in that game. And I got to go back and really dive in to see if this is it, from. But my gut feeling was that DeMeco had his defensive lineman play a little bit differently and a little bit more conservatively at times as the year went along, and that paid off. Foley Fatakasi, you know, when Foley Fatakasi gets signed yesterday, Jonathan Alexander put out the stats simply of rush yards allowed when Fatakasi was in the game versus when he wasn't, or when he was available and when he wasn't. And it was there was a big difference.
It was a big difference. Okay, yeah, I like
and
that.
And just as it is in basketball, you got to be careful with the plus minuses.
I was just going to say.
Fatakasi also wasn't out there on a 3rd and 20 when a guy runs for 19 yards.
Feels like there's a reverse Jalen Green effect going on now with Fatakasi.
But he is more of a run-stuffing type of dude than a lot of those other defensive tackles.
Someone just texted in, the Ladd McConkey touchdown in the playoffs sticks in my mind, right?
And that was that one was a simple matter of this is one of the big things, the tackling. Yeah. And they were a bad tackling team last year, as they've been for basically 4 years straight.
Yeah.
They were where did I have the tackling? Sixth most missed tackles. They had the sixth most. They were the sixth best at missing tackles last year.
Okay. I know who would phrase it that way.
Yeah. And this is something that DeMeco changed his conversation about this as the season went along. You know, we've heard in the past, you know, the linebacker that ended up going from the Jets.
Cashman.
Yeah, Cashman. Thank you. Yeah. Blake Cashman, a couple years ago in the post game, had said that, no, they don't, the coaches don't worry about missed tackles. They just want guys to shoot their shot. The mentality being that, oh, as long as you have a swarm mentality, then everybody's rallying to the ball, and you like to take the shot at the turnover.
Yeah.
That's always graded against me because it's possible to go for the big hit and a form tackle. Ronnie Lott was magnificent at going for the big hit, but also form tackling. And a lot of teams that have good defenses are really good tacklers, but they also still come up with a lot of big hits. DeMeco, as the year went along, started harping more on, we got to clean up these missed tackles. Because the problem with the swarm mentality is, okay, when you get into a game in the playoffs against the Chiefs, and the first guy, Azeez Elshire, misses a tackle versus Travis Kelce, if everybody else is all spread out across the field because you're playing the freaking Chiefs, old man Kelce gets another 15 yards out of it.
Yeah.
So it's like the swarm can only cover up so much. That Ladd McConkey was a perfect one. They were in a position to just tackle him dead to rights there at the spot, and he ends up the one in the middle of the field, and he ends up breaking the tackle and jetting down the field. So, yeah, the tackling just flat out has to improve. The other question I get whenever I talk about this is, well, how do you improve tackling when you're not allowed to tackle in pads? This is the big secret that nobody wants to admit. Nobody teaches tackling well at any level of football. And they think they do, and they stress on it and harp on it. There are many ways that you can. There are teams in the NFL who tackle well because they work on it, and they're operating under the same CBA as every other team. You can't excuse poor tackling by saying, well, we can't tackle because we're not in pads. Right. Okay, well, other teams are doing it far better than you, and they work at it. There's a boatload of drills you can do with no pads on that where you can improve your tackling.
You've said many times, so I should probably remember this better, the exact juncture, but you didn't realize that you weren't a great tackler until you got taught how to tackle. And I forget who it was by.
It was my fifth year in the NFL. It was the first time I got proper tackling instruction.
And what
by
was
anybody.
The instruction? Like, what changed it for you?
Frank Gantz Sr. was the special teams coach for the Jaguars at the time. And I'm in an offseason where they drafted Marcus Stroud in the first round. Yep. Gary Walker was it was going to be Marcus Stroud and Gary Walker probably starting. And I was going to get pushed out by the first round pick. And I ended up just talking to Frank Gantz about it. And about, you're like, hey, you know, I see the work you do with the special teams guys. I'd like to work on my tackling. So I spent the entire offseason going out with a special teams coach after workouts. And after I went out every day on the field with him and worked with him for like 10 minutes on tackling mm-hmm. drills. And I ended up becoming just 100% a better tackler just in one offseason because I actually worked with him. And Frank Gantz had it broken down to a science.
Yeah.
It was really cool. And, you know, like Ronnie Lott worked at it his entire career. People like to think that, well, he was just this guy who's naturally a good tackler. No, he went out on a heavy bag and worked on his approach, his hits, all of that, every practice in his NFL career.
I'm always fascinated by solutions sitting right there. You know what I mean? And that's like, this fascinates me because was it something when you started doing those drills with him in the offseason where you realized, like, holy crap, this is going to make a big difference? Or did you not realize how big a difference it made till you played, either practiced or played in your first preseason game, like with pads on? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I didn't really go, well, you get it ingrained in you because you're doing these drills all the time. And all of a sudden, I was hitting with the right body position. The biggest thing in the NFL, because what people say, well, there's no pads. How do you practice tackling? They haven't gone to the ground in tackling in the NFL. And I don't know, since the 1960s, maybe.
Yeah.
So practicing in pads or not has nothing to do with it. Guys don't get tackled to the ground hardly ever in NFL practices. Mm-hmm. So it really is that what happens is coaches get lazy. Because what you need to do when you're practicing in no pads is be really on point with your approach, your angles, and then going through the motions of bringing your arms and then continuing to run. So you let the ball carrier go past you, but you keep driving your legs.
Yeah.
You're basically tackling air after that point. But over the course of a season, coaches are they're so obsessed with their whiteboards and their game plans and everything else that they allow guys to just start getting lazy and tag guys off and everything. So it is really a matter of focusing on it. And it is. They get almost universally, all except the best tackling teams, the coaches get lazy with it because they're worried more about how can they be the next whiteboard genius.
You played 10 years in the league. A very small percentage of guys who go to the NFL play 10 years. Do you look back and look at Frank Gantz as a guy who's one of the big reasons you played in the league for 10 years?
Well, I think he's one of the reasons that I became a better player.
Yeah.
Like, my fifth year in the NFL, I became a much better football player all of a sudden. And there were a few things. It was a motivator. I ended up starting that whole season over Marcus Stroud. Like, it was a big motivator for me. That's why I never discount, a guy getting a motive. Like, kind of a, it wasn't like I was lazy or anything.
No.
But I was never, I didn't have that same sense of urgency as of, like, oh, no, crap, dude, I'm about to be a backup.
Hardworking people can get a wake-up call. Like, that's possible.
Right. So I had a different level of urgency.
Yeah.
And then, it was a big part of it. I was a different player, partly because of him. And then Vic Fangio and Dom Capers, when I got to Houston, just transformed me completely. That's why I also, I'm always open to, like, maybe Kenyon Green going to Philadelphia.
Yeah.
If he can stay healthy, he might end up being a really good player just if the scheme fits him better.
Yep.
Because the scheme in Houston fit me a lot better than the scheme in Jacksonville.
All right, so Seth Payne's four-point plan to fix the Texans' defense. Get it from being good to great, really.
Genuinely,
right?
Elite.
Genuinely elite. Number one is just to reset here. People are getting in their cars. Explosive plays allowed on defense. Minimize those.
And a lot of that comes down to Kalen Bullock continuing to mature, CJ Gardner-Johnson hopefully being a good addition, Jalen Petrie being, you know, a second year in this role that he theoretically should be a little bit better. A lot of those things that they're not huge changes. Kalen Bullock's probably the biggest X factor. He just needs to continue on his trajectory.
Jimmy Ward staying healthy because you know you're going to need to tap into depth at some point at that position. Tackling, we just went through. That's number two. All right, what else we got here? What else?
Just flat out, the linebacker play, especially when it comes to pass coverage and tight end specifically.
Yeah.
I'll use a fantasy stat here just because this is what kicks most people in the gut the most.
Scratching me right where I itch. Let's go.
The first thing that three people tweeted at me after Tyler Warren went to the Colts, the Texans suck versus tight ends.
That's fair.
Yes, they did. Seventh most fantasy points to tight ends last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of Houstonians going to be drafting Tyler Warren in their fantasy drafts this year.
And a lot of this comes down to the, like, I don't think Henry Toa is probably ever going to be brilliant in pass coverage as a linebacker. I think Christian Harris has a lot of potential in coverage, so he's a huge X factor there. But there were times last year, and we saw it in the Ravens game on the goal line, you know, Christian Harris just flat out missed and Mark Andrews. He was supposed to be in coverage on Mark Andrews there. Mm-hmm. He bit on the run fake, and Mark Andrews was wide open in the end zone. Henry Toa versus Sam Laporta, just, he's not going to cover Sam Laporta step for step all the way downfield, but he had a couple of missteps early in the down. He just took a bad step early in the down, and he got caught trailing to where Sam Laporta was wide open.
Yeah.
They don't have to be magnificent in coverage, but they've just got to be smarter and more experienced and more polished in coverage. And is it like Aziz Alshire is what he is in coverage. And the coaching side of it is they got to just be sure. Kind of like the Texans did a great job with Brian Cushing for a long time. You just limit the exposure. Just be sure that you're putting him in good position, that he's in passing lanes, or that he's not going to, you know, put himself in a position where he can get exposed and you're not putting too much on him.
I felt like Alshire was good in coverage in the early part of the year, and then when he got that knee injury, it seemed like he lost the step. Like that Bills game, Alshire should have had two interceptions in that game. Like, he was right there. There were times where early in the season he got matched up on receivers and he was running stride for stride with guys, but you're right. By the end of the year, it wasn't good, and it was horrible in that playoff game with Travis Kelce. It was an abomination against Kelce. Yeah.
And that includes the safeties again. I mean, we've already touched on the safeties, but the tight ends have just been too much of a headache when they face good. And, I mean, like Travis Kelce, we've just seen it over and over again in the playoffs. He's a different dude in the playoffs, and they just figured out way too many ways to get the ball to Travis Kelce. Like, Travis Kelce looked like the old Travis Kelce in the playoffs compared to what he did in the regular season.
A lot of people weighing in on the text page. We'll get to your text in just a second. But, Seth, what is point number four of the Seth Payne four-point plan to take the Texans to an elite level this year?
We touched on this, but the run defense in general. Yeah. And they were one of the better run defenses in the NFL, but some of the big runs were just a combination of, at times, defensive line play. But I do think they made some structural improvements to this as the year went along. Really, after the Green Bay game, I think there was kind of a change. But then, again, it goes back to the linebackers and the safeties just having the right leverage and being in the right spots. The big runs are usually the result of a breakdown on three levels of the defense. Mm-hmm. You've got a defensive lineman that gets blocked. You've got a linebacker who's a little bit out of position. And then if the safety's not right there, then it's off to the races. So a lot of this is stuff. It's frustrating that the Texans have allowed this many big plays because they're not – if you're a team that blitzes a boatload or something, then you expect to give up some big plays along the way. The Texans have managed to make a boatload of plays behind the line of scrimmage without having to blitz to do it. And theoretically, when you're playing zone behind it, you should limit the big plays. And it really boils down to mental errors and technique breakdowns, which theoretically is easy to clean up, especially when you've got so many young guys in the secondary. It's just you got to follow through on it. The tackling included in that run.
Well, that's what somebody says. I hate these. Oh, okay. This person's saying they're saying I hate these tackles where they lunge at the legs. I thought they were saying like the defensive tackles, those players. They're talking about the actual like tackling. Like I hate when guys. I'll rephrase it. I hate when guys tackle when they just lunge at their legs and they don't wrap. How many misses are attributed to that? A lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Yeah. No. And it really is. It's frustrating for me because I've seen both sides of it, where the conventional way that people coach tackling from Pop Warner to high school to college to the NFL, it's not enough. It's just not enough. And I think people they spend a few minutes on it at the beginning of practice or whatever. You go back to the Legion of Boom, and those guys had a tackling specialist coach. They practiced that. They're one of the teams that started off using more of a rugby style of tackling. And they were, when they were really, really good, they were also a very good tackling team. So a lot of the second, what would be a second and four with a missed tackle all of a sudden becomes a second and one, you know, like, mm-hmm. and that stuff adds up over time.
That's huge, man. That is absolutely, especially when you're playing against inferior quarterbacks. You know, I think of the game where Will Levis, you know, the Texans sacked Will Levis 8 times. But that was a big play game. That was a, you know, that probably doesn't fit what you're talking about getting, you know, getting the teams getting into favorable down and distance situations. But when you're playing, you know, like the Texans lost a few games this year, they had no business losing. And it was because of stuff that you're talking about there in the run game, poor tackling, explosive plays allowed on defense. Of all those things you just named, the 4 things to fix to make them elite: allowing explosive plays on defense, poor tackling, covering tight ends, the run defense. What's your, just to put a bow on this, like, what's your confidence level in them fixing this? And what to you, like, what's the most fixable thing here that can make the biggest impact?
I think the biggest thing, especially when you go up against good quarterbacks in the playoffs or on the road, is the explosive passes allowed on defense. That's where I should have called it explosive passes, because the runs are an issue also. But that was the stuff that was really just, they're all, you can, you know, immediately after the play, okay, this is where we screwed up. You're not getting beat physically. You're just, it's a matter of just really getting, and because the Texans had 2 rookies starting in the defensive backfield last year, and one guy in Derek Singley, I mean, I've got no complaints with him, but just to point to the youth of the situation,
sure,
they were young in the defensive backfield.
Oh, yeah.
And having health at safety, that if C.J. Gardner-Johnson and Jimmy Ward can both be healthy, I think you could get a big turnaround in that in 1 year.
Yep.
And that's 20. I mean, they had 10 touchdowns on passes of 20 yards or more.
That's crazy.
That doesn't also include all of the chunk plays that got teams down into the red zone on big chunk passing
that's
plays.
That's exactly right. Those are just touchdowns. Yeah, no question. Let's see. Bunch of text coming in on this topic here. Ideally, when should a person learn proper tackling versus when it's likely that they do?
Ideally in 4th grade.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Really. Yeah. There's a whole, I gotta call Frank Gantz Sr.'s son, Frank Gantz Jr., because he's probably got archives of it. Frank Gantz Sr. was awesome because he was this old, he was a Naval Academy guy.
Yeah.
He was a Navy pilot before he went, you know, and then got out and then went into football coaching. But he was a really good storyteller, and he would bring up stories of like battles, military history from battles from history. But then he would also use a lot of boxing footage.
Yeah.
So, and his whole thing was always just what I talked about with Ronnie Lott. Like, you don't have to forsake the form tackle to get a big hit. They go hand in hand. You should be hitting the guy in the exact same spot to get a big hit as you do when you go for a form tackle. But it's all about approaching and attacking the right quadrant of the body. You quarter the man.
Oh,
so you're attacking the weakest quarter of his body. Very military, you know. Like,
yeah,
all right, we're going to attack the weak spot here. And then you're going to deliver a rising blow through that quarter, that upper body quarter closest to you, and then keep running on through it. So he would use boxing footage a lot to show how to deliver, how to use your hands and feet together and deliver the blow up through a guy's head or body.
Oh,
it was really cool.
The way you describe Frank Gantz Sr., I like to think that his form tackling, there's a book somewhere, like an old book, like in Game of Thrones, where there's a library and it's got a huge hardcover. The edges of the pages are burned and tattered, and you open it up and it's all just drawings and calligraphy and things like that of guys tackling each other. Like, that's
either that or pictures in crayon of
stuff
that's disturbing if you see the 4th grader do it.
Right.
Like, oh, we got to call in a counselor.
Something very rugged that found its way onto the high seas when he was in the Navy in the day, you know?
Well, so the other thing, this is why I get so frustrated when I see an offensive lineman pancake somebody and then stand and admire his work.
Yeah.
Because, like, Frank Gantz, the Medal of Honor that you could get in a football standpoint was that if you decked somebody and then ran up and then leveled somebody else. So block 2, that was his standard. You need to be such a vicious hitter that you were gonna block 2. So yeah, destroy the first guy, but don't stand around like an idiot in a movie who's like looking at the guy he just killed and he gets shot in the head. Just go, keep going. Keep going. Why are you stopping? There's still football being played.
Oh, my God.
So if you block 2, or if you decked somebody and then like and then went on and made the tackle or something.
Yeah.
Like that would be would celebrate that like crazy.
That's
it would be like you just won the war.
Extra cookie for you right there, pal. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. I'm so glad.
Yeah, I don't get that. Like when people they pancake somebody, offense or defense. And then you just, like, the play's still going on, and you're standing there.
No,
like,
that...
How selfish are you?
That might be the biggest thing that Nick Caley and Cole Popovich need to fix with the Texans' offensive line, is stopping.
Oh, they're like, oh, I pass-blocked you for 3 seconds.
Yeah.
That's as good as a pancake.
Yeah.
I'm gonna wait around for
a
while.
Right. No, I talked to my union rep. 3 seconds is all you're getting on every play, okay? Anything else is time and a half.
PFF, well, you know what? No, honestly.
Yeah.
Like when players start bragging about their own PFF pass protection grades, they only expect you to block for a certain amount of time, and then after that, it's the quarterback's fault. So that's a pervasive mentality of like, I did my job.
Oh,
I blocked him for three and a half seconds.
Advanced film watching day and age that we're in. That was good stuff, man. All right. If you missed it, Seth just basically fixed everything on the defense, as if it needed a lot of fixing. The things that needed fixing... got fixed. You can listen to that on the Odyssey Rewind or on the podcast. Shifting gears here. Okay, I like listening to the clips we get from the other shows on the station. I enjoy it. We've got a very good lineup here at Sports Radio 610 that I listen to throughout the day, and you should as well, faithful listener. Patrick Creighton last night. Okay, I like it also when other hosts on the station refer to things they're hearing on the radio and stuff like that. I'm like, oh, okay, well, I know they listen to us. Do we think, you want to set this up, Seth? Do we think that Patrick Creighton's talking about us here?
I don't know. Yeah, that's what I was trying to figure out. So I'll play the first. Patrick Creighton is upset with some of the discourse surrounding Jose Altuve right now.
Yep.
And I wondered. Yeah, like, okay, let's. Wait a second. Is he taking a shot at me? Mm-hmm. Our listeners can confirm or deny whether he is.
There's a reason why I sometimes hate listening to sports radio. When you hear guys that you know and you like start talking about the idea of, hey, is Jose Altuve getting old? Is he slowing down? Is he no longer, like, are we watching him age before our eyes because he's in a slump for the last 2 weeks?
That's been the birthday conversation for Jose Altuve for like 4 years now.
It's an asinine conversation.
Asinine. Okay. Now,
okay, I don't think he's talking about it because we really haven't had any of those conversations about. We've been worried about other things for the most part on the Astros more so than Altuve's age.
Well, let's work from outside in here to see if we're part of the subset. The only thing he said about the hosts that are saying this are hosts that he knows. He knows us. And give us a ding here. He knows us, Patrick Creighton. And he says, and he likes. I think Patrick Creighton likes both of us. I like Patrick.
I think he does.
Yeah.
That puts us right in the Venn diagram.
We're in the subset. Yeah, so we are in the subset. So now we get to what you were just saying, and we have to self-assess here. Have you and I been talking about Jose Altuve like he is verging on washed up? Like getting
I don't think we have. I think, though, but it depends on how people hear what we're saying, because it's undeniable that he's slowed down.
Yeah.
Which is what happens when you get older.
Yeah.
His sprint speed is 1.5 miles per hour slower now and has been for a couple years than it was in 2015. Like, he's slower. They moved him to left field specifically because his defense has declined.
Yeah.
And especially when they changed the shift rules, it became very apparent that he's just not the same guy that he used to be. So I don't think he's talking about us because we haven't been really harping on Altuve much at all because there's so many other things to harp on. But like, I can't sit here and act like he's not getting slower because he totally is. I don't think that the current slump he's in is what he's going to be like the rest of the season.
Just to put some numbers around the slump that he's in, the last time he was batting over, he was off to a hot start. He was easily their best hitter through the first couple weeks of the season. The last time he was over 300 for bat, I'm just going to use batting average. The last time he had a batting average over 300 was 14 games ago. In the last 14 games, which, by the way, the Astros are 7-7 in those games. They are the ultimate 500 baseball team. They don't win a lot in a row. They don't lose a lot in a row. And they just go back and forth and yada, yada, yada. They're 18-18. But back to Altuve. Since then, he's batted 175 with a 535 OPS. So this isn't, I'm not bringing these numbers up just to say, yep, you know what, Patrick, you're wrong. He's washed. I'm just trying to contextualize just what kind of slump he's in right now. There's a bad slump that he's in right now. The one thing I would say when I first listened to that audio was when Patrick, I think asinine was the word that he used that I wrote down. There will come a day when this argument is no longer asinine. Like, he's not, right. You know, like, to Altuve, if Altuve plays out his contract through the age of 39, I feel comfortable in betting that he is not going to be an 800 OPS guy at the age of 39. There's a reason why the salaries the last 2 years of that contract are only $10 million a year. Like, both parties have come to the realization that there's going to be a tail off at some point here.
They put it right in there. Yeah. And I think the biggest thing with Altuve is that I think sometimes people really don't realize how good he was in 2022 and 2023.
Yeah.
Like, those were, in a lot of ways, some of his best seasons as a pro. And he did that at age 32 and 33. So I think last year, it is tempting to look at, okay, last year he's 34 years old and he dropped off a bit from the previous couple seasons. Last year, though, was still in line in a lot of ways with 2014, 2015, his 2018 season,
yeah,
his 2019 season, right? He was still pretty much himself in a lot of ways last year. So that's where I think it's, whether, I don't know if I'll call it asinine, because when a guy's 35 years old, I think it's fair to have the aging conversation.
Yes.
This current slump right now, it's just too short-lived for me to feel like, no, okay, now this is when he's old. Because last year he was still as good as he's been for the bulk of his career.
Yep. And he's streaky, man. He can go on a heater at any time, Jose Altuve. So, yeah, I'm fine. Like, I'm nowhere near a conversation where I'm like, yeah, move him down to 7 in the batting order. Boy, he's going to be a 600 OPS guy all year. He's at 662 right now. He's going to hit at some point, but it's almost inarguable that he's a declining player. You know, like,
defensively, at least, especially.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, he is in decline right now, but I don't think it's a precipitous decline where there's, like, alarms going off or anything, you know?
In some of the aging stuff is, okay, he's not as fast as he once was, and that's nothing to be alarmed about, because I didn't expect him to continue to being a base-stealing maven on into his late 30s.
That's the biggest thing. Like, honestly, where I have been, and I think you and I both have been most critical of Jose Altuve, if there's anything, it's been the decisions he makes on the base paths, and he's been doing that since he was at peak Altuve. Like, he's never been a disciplined base runner. I think the main thing that I criticize him for is something that I've criticized him for since his, you know, since his late 20s. Good. I feel comfortable then. There's no rift between Payne and Pendergast in Area 45. I mean, other than Bajani wanting to and thinking he can whoop your ass.
Right. No, that's the biggest mistake he's made. Yeah. And you know why he thinks he can do that? Because he's younger than me.
Yeah.
He thinks that old 50-year-old Sethers doesn't have what he used to have.
Right. No. He doesn't see you work out either. When we go on road trips, I've seen you work out like a maniac sometimes.
If this fight is played on an elliptical machine, watch out.
Look the hell out.
Watch out.
Yep. Yep.
Or a stationary bike.
Anything.
Yeah, you're in trouble.
Big machinery. Bajani's in trouble. Hell yeah.
If we need to go on a 90-minute hike through the woods first, I've got the advantage there. Yes.
Oh, someone said they're talking about Lopez. Okay, well, I'll ask John about that.
Did Lopez have a... Yeah, we'll have to do this at the toss. We'll play that for Lopez at the toss.
Good call.
We'll see
Yeah.
They basically called Lopez asinine.
Yeah, that's right. I like how you say they when it was only Patrick doing it, but that's what happens. Is like an opinion that gets conveyed on a two-person show gets attached to both guys.
I do. I would say I think that when you try to frame everything, I think that last year being a drop-off, so 2024 being a bit of a drop-off for Altuve compared to 2023, it looks worse than it is because of the age.
Yeah.
Whereas it still was in line with a lot of Altuve's seasons from when he was younger and still one of the best players in baseball. It's just that his highs have been so high that it's tempting to just think, oh, if he's not having one of those supremely good years, that he must be falling off. I mean, yes, he's gonna atrophy over time, but I don't think this current slump is necessarily about that.
Texter would like to know what kind of yogurt you're eating.
I eat Chobani plain Greek yogurt, and I mix my own fruit in with it.
Yeah, yeah.
I did. I tweeted something out the other day that people seem to like, which is don't worry, everybody. I'm not dying or anything. My A1C crept up a little bit, and like to the point where I was right at the border for where I could be pre-diabetic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I better take care of this right quick. And I've never worried about refined sugar all that much because I exercise a lot and everything,
sure.
So it doesn't tend to be. So I just cut out all refined sugar, and no big deal. It wasn't like a huge change or anything. And the thing I wasn't expecting was like all of a sudden I cut out refined sugar, and immediately I've been sleeping better than I have in my entire life.
Yeah.
My entire life.
Yep.
All 50 years.
Yep.
I've never been able to sleep in. I've hardly ever needed an alarm clock. So even when I'm dog tired, I'll still wake up.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time. All of a sudden, I am sleeping like a teenager on a Saturday morning. Yep. I'm out cold for 8 straight hours.
It's great advice because I've largely cut it out too. And it does.
Yeah.
It does help your sleep. I'm curious, the things in which you had refined sugar, do you have like zero sugar replacements for those things that actually still taste good?
Yeah,
or did you just cut those foods out altogether?
I don't. Oh, what do you mean zero sugar replacements?
Like, sometimes when I crave sweets, like I like whipped cream, but I have zero sugar whipped cream. You know what I mean?
Oh,
I don't drink any, I don't drink a single sugary drink. Everything, my Powerade is Powerade Zero. My sodas are Zevias, all those things.
I don't use any kind of sweetener at all.
Okay.
Because for me, personally, and this is not advice for anybody else because everybody's individual.
Yeah.
For me personally, it's just the taste of something sweet stokes my appetite.
That's why I ask. Yeah. That's interesting.
So even if it's whether it's zero calories or not, so it's there's some scientific reasoning for that, but it's like if I put artificial sweetener, like let's say in Greek yogurt, I'll eat the whole damn container.
Put some stevia in there. Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah, but if I'm just throwing some fruit in it myself, I'll eat 2 servings of it, and then that's it.
I got
so
you.
I just so that like obviously there's the fruit sweetness, but the fiber balances it out and all that. Yeah.
Yep. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. All right, Rockets and one of their most prominent players this offseason came to an agreement yesterday. Not a contract, but an agreement. How does this affect the way the Rockets are looking at the offseason? And was this other Rocket posting a goodbye to Houston? We will run that through the filter coming up next. All right, Payne and Pendergast, Rocket season is over, and now it's on to the offseason. And I would say that the Rockets, just blindly I would say this, I haven't power ranked it or anything, and obviously we've still got a few more rounds of the playoffs to go. There's still 8 teams playing basketball, but I can't imagine that the Rockets are outside of the top 5 most interesting teams around the league going into this offseason. You know, they surprised a lot of people with a 2 seed this year, winning 52 games. It's a young core where Jalen Green's playoff performance notwithstanding, it's a young core where all the young guys that matter are all, generally speaking, in ascension right now. I'm not going to take Jalen Green's playoff series against Golden State and say that he's not still an ascending player, but obviously he needs to get to another level if he's going to be the best guy on a championship-level team. He's got a lot of work to do that. But an interesting team. And so some of these action items, Seth, are now starting to get checked off. The biggest one, at least in the short term, was going to be, what does this team do with Fred VanVleet? Because the way Fred VanVleet's contract was written was that a decision needed to be made on his team option, which is nearly $45 million for next year. And it's the Rockets' decision. The decision needed to be made by the end of this week, 5 days after the Rockets' playoff run was over. That's how I don't know why it was written that way, because most of those options are pushed till after the playoffs. But that's now what the Rockets and Fred VanVleet have agreed to. They've agreed to take what was an imminent date, to make a decision on whether it's going to be opting into $45 million or, in all likelihood, a new deal that's a little longer with a smaller average annual value, still a lot of money, but just structured differently. They've now kicked that can down the road till June 29th. So they don't need to decide anything with Fred VanVleet until June 29th.
It's the kind of thing that it feels like you do when you're very close or have an agreement in philosophy, at least, and both sides like each other. So what can you know for sure? At the very least, it's not a contentious situation.
No, it's not contentious.
Right?
No, yeah. It's not contentious. And I think here's the thing, though. Like all these other moving parts that the Rockets are kind of outwardly kind of backing away from, and what I mean by that are things like Kevin Durant and Giannis Antetokounmpo, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Publicly, we heard Raphael Stone say it, like, bet on continuity is what he said earlier this week. They want, and I believe that their first choice is that to hope that this core that they've built is what takes them to the promised land eventually. But that may not be the case. And the thing that I think 5 days after the season's over doesn't give you enough time to gauge what that outside market is, because the fact of the matter is that if you opt into Fred VanVleet's $45 million, he becomes a pretty prominent part, could potentially be part of a trade, because you need those salaries to match up. I think the Rockets would not like to do that, because I think they want Fred VanVleet to be on this team. But I think kicking it down the road for another 6 weeks or whatever it is allows the dust to settle on all of the possibilities, as opposed to, like, we got to do this by Friday. Well, we don't even know if Kevin Durant wants out of Phoenix now.
Well, no. My point, though, is that but Fred has to agree to this as well to push it back. So
yes,
that's the part where it takes two.
Yeah.
Like, Fred VanVleet could have said, well, nope, sorry.
Take
that's
it early.
Deal.
Yeah, make a decision.
You got to do it. You got to make the decision now. Like, it suggests that both of the, Fred VanVleet wants to stay and the Rockets want him there. It's just a matter of, all right, let's hammer out. Are we on the same page in enough places that we can just kick this down the road a little bit? So it's, I 100% understand why the team would do it. It's why would Fred VanVleet agree to it? It's because he wants to be here.
Yep.
And that he feels like the Rockets are going to do right by him.
Yeah, and I get my scenario of them mixing him into a deal, I think it's so infinitesimally small. I absolutely think both sides want to be together, not just next year, but I think for multiple years too. So June 29th is now the date for that. So we can put that on the back burner for now. Steven Adams posted on Instagram yesterday, Seth, that I want you to, you tell me, does this sound like a goodbye to you? Because I think Steven Adams has gotten to a place with Rocket fans that he went from being a curiosity, because when they picked him up, it was at the trade deadline last year and he was injured, so you knew he was going to be on the team this year, but an aging player coming off an injury, to a guy who during the regular season, like, oh, okay, I kind of like what Steven Adams brings, he only plays every other game because they're managing his knee, but okay, to in the playoffs he became one of the most popular Houston Rockets of the last 5 to 10 years, it felt like, in the seven game series against the Warriors.
I mean the hard decision for the Rockets is exactly, all right, we, you know, with the big man lineup, for instance, the plus minus was incredible on it. It was very, very effective, but it's also something that they know they can't ride. It's one of those lineups that if you use it 30 minutes a night, time after time, you're going to run up against the wall at some point.
Yep.
Whether Steven Adams is completely healthy or not, I think even if he didn't have the minutes restrictions, things get clunky down there. So, what are they looking at? I think the biggest question is just, all right, is he 2 years, when he's 2 years removed from his injury, is he a guy that you can play just more minutes more frequently without having to have off nights and all that?
And it's not just the Rockets looking at him that way. Is the rest of the league looking at him that way? Because he is going to be a free agent. Now, you tell me, is this a goodbye? Houston, thank you. The energy, passion, and unwavering support you brought to the arena this year were nothing short of incredible. I hope we represented this city with the pride and resilience that define what it means to be a Houstonian. Going to battle with the brothers was an honor. We fought with grit, heart, and determination, displaying the kind of resilience that goes beyond the court. Proud of the boys and everything we learned together. End quote.
No, that just feels like an epilogue for the 2024-25 season.
It does? Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I was waiting for the hammer to drop, where I'll always have fond memories of Houston.
That would have been a goodbye.
This will always be a special place for me or anything. No, that felt very much like just the end of a chapter.
Okay.
Not the end of the whole damn book of Steven Adams in Houston.
So I wanted to bounce it off you. I knew you'd talk me off the ledge, because I want Steven Adams to stay for the press conferences, if nothing else. I tried to find the best cut. He had an epic press conference after game 6, I think it was, when they tied the series at 3. Take a listen to this. This is a reporter who asks one of those questions that's not really a question, but Steven Adams is the guy who's going to ask you, so was that a question, bro?
Much respect. You've been extremely aggressive. A lot of blocks. And want to see where this energy comes from. This last few games, a lot of blocks coming in. And much respect.
Thank you, bro. Was that a question? Oh, what is it? Where
does all this energy come from in this last few games with all the blocks?
Oh, no, that's just... Like, it just comes down to the defensive system, bro. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not like I'm going every time, you know what I mean? But, like, the boys on the ball is doing a really good job at making sure that these guys throw up an off-balance shot. Those are the ones you can go after, like the block shots, you know what I'm saying? So, yeah, it's just, like, you have to be there. If I'm the low guy, which I try to be, well, most of the time I try and be the low man so I could come over and contest the shots and stuff. Sometimes you get blocked, sometimes they just throw up something else. But it's just the job. But, yeah. Thanks, bro. What a nice man.
What a nice man.
You're a nice man. Dude, I honestly, like, you talk about veteran leadership. The deflecting of the compliment and crediting his teammates for putting him in position to make, as if he's just a recipient of all of that. That's a perfect answer. That is honestly, that was the perfect answer to a non-question.
Can't put a dollar amount on that, Tillman. Bring him back.
Play that. Did that not sound like the Magnificent Gladstone asking that question?
Let's play it one more time.
Much respect. You've been extremely aggressive. A lot of blocks. And I want to see where this energy comes from. This last few games, a lot of blocks coming in. And much respect.
It sounds a lot like him.
He's not as energetic as the Magnificent Gladstone, but kind of trying to sound almost like a little vocal fry social media influencer.
Yeah, 100%. That's a good catch by you.
You're so intangibly rich. Yes. I just wonder, where do you get this thing? If we're going to touch on a singular touch point, these blocks, how do you get there?
It was Remedial Gladstone. Like, it was Gladstone with a much more diminished vocabulary. You know, just a lot of one-syllable words and stuff. Like, Timu Gladstone is who that was right there.
One of those press conferences, the one where you realize there was an Australian reporter.
Had an accent a little bit, by the way. That might have been the guy.
Yeah. No, but did you see the one where Stephen Adams dropped an expletive? And he was like, yeah, he's bleeping Australian. Yeah, I saw that.
I like when he calls his teammates the lads, too. In one of his That's the one I tried to find. He's like, oh, the lads did good out there today. Like, the lads. Yeah. All right. So bring back Steven Adams is the upshot of all that. All right, to the 8 o'clock hour we go. Let's circle back. We had Nick Caserio on the show yesterday. The offensive line has been the biggest topic for the Texans this offseason. Where is Titus Howard going to be playing? The O-line rebuild, what's that been like? And he talked about rookie Ariante Ursary as well. So we've got Texans GM Nick Caserio. Cuts from that interview coming up next.